Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is Edgar and Emmy-nominated screenwriter and best-selling author Thomas B. Sawyer. Thomas and I will be discussing the secret in becoming a captivating storyteller and also his latest novel, Cross Purposes. Good morning, Thomas. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Terrific, Johnny. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. It is a pleasure to have you on the air. I have to let you know I was a big fan of Murder, She Wrote. So I just want to let you know that. Got to get that in there at the very beginning of the show.
Thank you. And by the way, you can call me Tom.
Wonderful, Tom. Thank you. Cross Purposes is a wonderful read. The book is very entertaining. It covers just about everything. It's got fun stuff in it, and of course it's a murder mystery theme and so forth, and it really engages me in so many ways. I've always enjoyed mystery and thriller books, and this one really did the job. So congratulations, sir.
Well, thank you.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, I grew up in Chicago. I was an only child. I started drawing pictures at age 3. My ambition, my boyhood ambition, was to do a comic strip, a story comic strip. That's an almost dead form these days, but back when I was a kid, they were a big deal. They were basically daily serials told in 3 or 4 panels in the daily paper, and it was a device, obviously, to sell newspapers.
Yeah.
And I went to New York at age 19 and started working in the comic books because that was sort of where you apprenticed in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for Stan Lee at Marvel Comics and, you know, people like that.
Yeah.
And after a few years, I realized, because I got to know the other a lot of the successful comic strip artists,
mm-hmm.
that it wasn't my kind of goal. The reason being that you did the same thing every day with the same tools and the same paper and the same, you know, brushes and ink.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have the patience for that. I need challenges. And
yeah.
I also realized, because I got to know these guys, that they were in a kind of a velvet line trap, because most of them who were successful were making big money in those days.
Yeah.
And they were all sort of damaged goods. They had drinking problems, womanizing problems, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
They were not a happy lot. So, cutting to the chase, I pursued advertising and magazine illustration, became known in the business of the Mad Men era as the Norman Rockwell of line illustration, and began making films. I discovered that I loved directing. I studied with Lee Strasberg at the Actors Studio. Discovered I love playing God. I made a couple of short films, including one that won a lot of awards, a documentary called Reunion, which can be viewed at, there's a link at my website to the YouTube link. And went to California to give it a try, to see if I could make it in show business, and I got lucky.
Fantastic. I mean, you've been doing some tremendous work over the years. When did you discover you have a talent for writing?
I guess long after I began doing it. I mean, in grade school, I was doing comic strips already. But even then, I thought that the writing was the easy part, that the challenge was learning how to draw well.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't really until I got to Hollywood and actually kind of an ironic, funny story. I'll be brief about it. When I got to Hollywood, my plan was to make a low-budget feature film as a calling card as a director. Well, the first thing that happened when my wife and two small children and I relocated to California was that my writer fell through, so I wrote the movie myself. And it wasn't that hard. It was based on an old joke. And so I shot the movie, and I started screening it. I had been there now a couple of years getting the movie made and what have you, and I began screening it for distributors because I had had to put up my own money to make the movie. And it was called, by the way, Alice Goodbody. It's a kind of a cult comedy. And I began screening it, and along with the distributors who hopefully would pick it up and help me get my money back, I began inviting the people in the business who I had begun to meet and socialize with. And one of them, at one of the screenings early on, a very talented lady by the name of Lila Garrett, we're still friends. She was an Emmy-winning writer, director, producer. She came up to me and she said, "You should be writing for television." And I was literally, Johnny, I was flabbergasted. I didn't know what to say because I had never thought of A, writing, and B, television. I was going to be a director. So I said, "So, Lila, how would I get started doing that?" And she said, well, she shrugged, and she said, "Well, I got a production deal. You got an idea, call me."
Yeah.
2 weeks later, I call her, and typical Beverly Hills lady, I can't talk now. I'm on my way out to a meeting. And I said,
interesting.
And my instincts were good even then, Johnny. For brevity, I said, "Lila, I'm going to give you one line."
Yeah.
And she said, "Okay. Quick, what is it?" And I said, "A gang comedy on a tacky used car lot in the valley." And there was this appropriately timed comic pause, and she said, "That's great. You'll write it, and I'll produce it." 10 days later, my first job in Hollywood, I was writing a pilot for CBS.
Awesome.
Now, it was years before I realized that that isn't the way it works for everyone. But at the time, I didn't know, so I said, "Oh, okay, that's how tough is that?"
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to learn along the way, though. I mean, I would think.
And gradually, I realized that I knew more about storytelling than I thought I did. In no small part, because when I was and doing illustration and cartooning, I shared a studio with a bunch of guys, and I don't know if there's right brain, left brain, but you can talk while you're doing that kind of work.
We would
tell jokes every day in the studio. Somebody would come in with a new joke. He'd tell it, and then for the next 2 hours, we would deconstruct it and punch it up. We would, well, what if you put this sentence in front of that one, or this word in front of that. And in the process, without even realizing, I was learning, if you can tell jokes, you're a storyteller. And that was how I really think that I learned how to become a writer.
That's fantastic. That's wonderful. It's one of those things that I believe you have this innate talent, and the environment, situations that occurred that sort of extract that from you, and the creative juices started to flow naturally.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. A very good reading of that,
Fantastic. When you were growing up, were there authors that you favored that sort of influenced the way you thought?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. My favorites were Hammett, Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler. They both wrote mysteries. the historian Carl Sandburg and novelists and short story writers John O'Hara and Irwin Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
They were my favorites and still are.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And you sort of, as you refine yourself, then obviously you focus on the mystery side of the business. Why is that?
Well, that really, it focused me. I had done a few mysteries, a Quincy and a couple of Quincy episodes and things like that early on in my television career. But then one day I got a call from my agent that a fellow named Peter Fisher wanted to see me, wanted me to come in. He was starting a new series called Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah.
And it wasn't on the air yet, and I knew nothing about it. And I went and met Peter, and he sent me in the next room to look at the pilot. And all I could think of as I was watching was, oh, my God, I'm going to get a chance to write for Angela Lansbury?
Yeah.
I mean, because believe me, you write for a lot of very mediocre actors when you're writing television episodes,
for
various series.
Right.
And so I came out of the room, and I was wowed, you know, and I said, Peter, I said, I think you got a real hit on your hands. He said, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
And this following brief conversation was, I said, so, Peter, what kind of mysteries are these going to be? And he sort of shrugged and said, sort of Agatha Christie puzzle mysteries. Mm-hmm. And without even processing, I said, Peter, I have to tell you, when I read a couple of Christie's and a couple of locked room mysteries when I was a kid, where they get all the suspects in the drawing room at the end. And I said, they bored the hell out of me, and I won't write that for you.
Yeah.
And he said, what will you write? I said, I'll write the Maltese Falcon. And without missing a beat, he said, that'll be fine. And what's cool about that, Johnny, is two things. One, he understood exactly what I was saying, and I'll tell you in a minute what I was saying.
Yeah.
And the other was that it really turned out to be arguably my signal contribution to the series before it ever went on the air. What I was saying, and he understood, was that Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett is still the seminal modern detective story. It was the novel that broke away from the Agatha Christie pattern.
Yeah.
And how he did it and what the Maltese Falcon is a murder mystery with no clues and no suspects. It was a play about a group of really interesting characters who were all in conflict with each other, all of them trying to get their hands on the black bird, the item that Alfred Hitchcock referred to as the MacGuffin in a story, the object that everyone is after. And you almost didn't care who had murdered Miles Archer, Sam Spade's partner, because you were so fascinated by these characters and their machinations. And that became the format, really, the pattern for Murder, She Wrote. We did a play every week about a bunch of interesting people who were in conflict with each other over something, and somebody got murdered.
Very interesting. I remember watching that show, and two characters, of course, came to mind will be obviously Angela Lansbury's role, but Tom Bosley did a wonderful job as the sheriff.
He did, and we worked with him for several years, and then there was sort of a parting of the ways, and we went on, changed it around a little bit, and introduced the doctor character, Seth Hazlitt. Tom was great to write for and great to work with.
How challenging was it to come up with the weekly scripts for the TV series?
It's hard, but not that hard. You know, I didn't write them all, obviously. Over the 12-year period, I wrote 24 of them, and that also included a year away from the show doing the spinoff with called The Law and Harry McGraw mm-hmm. with Jerry Orbach. There were about three or four or five of us who were the core writers for the show. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we were able to take our time with the scripts. We spent more time. I mean, I worked on other series, action adventure shows, where I'd write them in 4 days, the hour script. The Murder, She Wrote scripts took from 2 to 3 months to write.
Wow. Do you daydream a lot?
Yeah. Yeah, I make up stories and talk to myself.
Interesting. I would think you have to do that because if you're working on multiple projects, and not even multiple projects, I mean, heck, you're working on one project, and like they say, the show must go on. You got to come up with something unique and different. And I would always think that, well, today's show is the best one since the last show we did last week. You know what I'm talking about? It's like it has to be a better show each week.
It was always a challenge, and as I said, I didn't have to create one every week. I was often guiding the other. Once I took over the series in the eighth season, I was also guiding the other writers. And dealing with helping them along with their scripts and so mm-hmm. on. So, it wasn't a debilitatingly frantic business, mm-hmm. though, to mm-hmm. my surprise, even though, yeah. I mean, the truth is we only had to do 22 episodes a year.
Right.
And so we had 2 or 3 months of what we called hiatus, where we were preparing mm-hmm. scripts. And while it wasn't, exactly leisurely, it wasn't high pressure.
Mm-hmm. What makes a good mystery story?
Well, as I said, for me, a bunch of interesting characters in conflict, pursuing a goal or goals, and someone gets murdered. I mean, the Maltese Falcon is still the benchmark for me.
Yeah. Once the stories get written, do the actors have any input in the story?
No, none. The closest the closest we ever came to, as a matter of fact, Johnny, the mystery genre mystified the network, too. Every other series that I had worked on, and I was on staff on 15 different series, we had to clear the scripts with the network on every show, and we got input from them and, notes.
Yeah.
On Murder, She Wrote, they didn't give us any input or feedback because they didn't understand the mystery form.
Ah, interesting.
So for 12 years, we could do anything we wanted. And, of course, that meant a certain amount of trust and so on. But, the only time that an actor ever gave me any input resulted in the following. Angela one day said, mm-hmm. I don't know if you feel this way, but she said, I feel like we're doing too many stories that have backstories that we have to, fill the audience in. Do you have any ideas? Would you come up with a few ideas for shows? So I said, sure. Yeah. With no backstory. So I pitched several to her,
mm-hmm.
and she didn't like any of them. And so she said, so do you have anything else? And I had been struggling with what turned out to be my first novel for how to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew what the story was, and in general. And I waggishly said, well, I do have one other story, but I said, Angie, it's the mother of all backstories. Which, of course, of course, hooked her. And she said, okay, what is it? And I said, Jessica Fletcher solves the murder of the century, almost. It was the assassination.
Oh, interesting.
And I explained it to her, and she said, good. And so it resulted in an episode called Dead Eye, which was about a dead private eye who had vanished all those years earlier with the secret to who killed Jack Kennedy.
Right. Interesting. Very interesting. I would imagine working with like Angela Lansbury or even anyone that is doing a particular role, a series over 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 seasons, I would think the actors sort of like immerse themselves into the role and they become the role, perhaps even offset a little bit to kind of get into that zone, so to speak. Does that happen quite often?
Yes, I guess it does sometimes, although Angela was such a professional that she was able to go, you know, be herself and all of that. So I didn't encounter that a lot or that kind of or any temperament really on the part of certainly not Angela. She was great with actors. She was generous with them, you know, and helped them on the set. She didn't mind having other actors excel.
Yeah.
She encouraged it.
Well, obviously, she's a very confident woman. I mean, she exudes that sort of that commanding yet leisure presence in every one of the episodes. I mean, growing up, what I'm looking at, that would be a wonderful grandma to have.
Absolutely.
Respectfully, Absolutely. That is. I mean, not that she's old, but I'm just saying it, you know.
No. She really was just extraordinary. I mean, and continues to be. She's close to 90 now and still performing. We're still in touch with each other. She won 3 Tonys over the last couple of seasons on Broadway.
Yeah. So that's awesome. Wonderful. Was it easier to write a feature film or to write for a TV series?
Well, it's a sort of a yes and no. With a feature, it's often a standalone with one-time characters, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's easy, even though, you know, you have to tell a longer, more complex story. But with a series, you've got a core of hopefully interesting characters to work with every week. And it does make it, I think, easier than writing a feature film. You know, and plus it's only 55 pages for an hour script as opposed to 105 to 120 for a feature film.
Okay, sure. Very interesting. Do you guys incorporate the actor's personality in some way as the episode goes on and on and on and the writers pick up specific things about the actors playing a specific role and then sort of incorporate that in their role on screen?
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. Early on, as I was, you know, watching the series and watching, you know, seeing the dailies every day, it occurred to me that we weren't making anywhere near the full use of Angela Lansbury's acting range. I mean, Jessica Fletcher was a fairly bland character.
Yeah.
You know, she was nice and pleasant, but there were rarely any sparks. And I felt that, that I'd love to use more of what she could do as an actress. And as I was viewing the early episodes, I discovered that on the few occasions when someone would say the equivalent of, Mrs. Fletcher, I don't have time for you. Get out of my office. She would get her back up and be angry.
Yeah.
You know, and insist on talking to the guy, and the whole show would light up and come to life. So I contrived that we gave her at least one of those moments in every episode, just to utilize her gift for creating sparks.
Yeah, yeah. That's fascinating. That's very, very interesting.
Of course, is what it's all about in entertainment. You know, people agreeing with each other are boring.
That's true. So true. How much research do you do for each project that you work on?
Well, it varies. Today, with the web, of course, it's become far easier. You can even talk to Google and tell it what to search for, you know?
Yeah.
But when I wrote my first novel, I had to travel to Utah to soak up the area around Moab so I could describe it a little bit. But today I might not need to do so. You know, that was you know, 14 years ago. So there's a certain amount of research, obviously, but it's not backbreaking and not exhausting. And since one of the things about Murder, She Wrote was we never got clinical about the murders, like the forensics shows that they do now.
Right, right.
I mean, that was never what it was about. We never showed blood or gore.
Right.
We had three motives on Murder, She Wrote: money, sex, or power.
I remember it was very entertaining.
We never did crazy people. We never did serial killers, you know, which
Well,
out of me.
The shows now are much more intense, and it really, in some cases, get underneath your skin. As an audience, let me put it this way. It could be things that are really happening out there that we're just not privy to, because after all, the United States is a huge place, or the world, so to speak, so there are some cynical people that are out there that are committing crimes or whatever you want to call it. And then there's a moment, on the other hand, to me, there's a very fine line when you talk about TV entertainment, Family Hour, that you do want to be just entertained, have a good time, you want to have a nice, tasteful murder mystery, and yet it's a wonderful wholesomeness of feeling of rejuvenation in some ways. It's just a nice R&R and being entertained, if that makes sense.
Oh, I agree totally, Johnny. There seems to be, I mean, I get contacted from time to time, as recently as a couple of months ago, to come up with an idea for a murder mystery show, not unlike Murder, She Wrote, but aimed at a younger demographic. That's the key these days.
Yeah.
I mean, I just read that the Longmire series, which was a mystery, got canceled because of demographics, because the audience was in its 60s rather than younger. And as a matter of fact, after 12 years and still being in the top 10, that was the reason Murder, She Wrote got canceled.
I see. Do you use your writing to express yourself or just to entertain others? And what I mean by this is that now that you do incorporate the personalities of the actors into the scripts that you write, do you sometimes sort of exude yourself inside the various scripts themselves as well?
Oh, a lot of the time. I mean, not so much in television, although I was surprised at how often you could do that in television.
Yeah.
I was doing an episode of a series called Kaz early in my career. It was about it starred Ron Liebman as a young lawyer who had been convicted of a crime. While he was in prison, he became a lawyer and got himself out. And he was hired as the sort of token lowlife in this Tony high-level law firm. and the shows focused on the cases that he handled, which were mostly pro bono or not very high revenue. And I was asked to write for the show, and they said, why don't we do a thing? There's a lot of battered women now getting sent to prison for killing their mates.
Right.
And why don't we try to do a show about that? So they gave me a bunch of research, and I went home over the weekend and I did even more research. And what I discovered was that, yeah, these battered women were getting convicted of murdering these guys who beat them.
Right.
And I came back to them and I said, okay, here's what I want to do. I want to send a message to battered women. I want our case, I want the woman to get away with it.
Yeah.
Because I want to send a message to these guys who beat their wives that your wife can kill you and not go to prison for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they all applauded that. And that's the way I wrote it. Mm-hmm. And it did make that statement, and we got thousands of pieces of mail, and the script was picked up by women's groups, and the show was praised by them. So it was very satisfying.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow,
but
that's awesome.
Exception in television.
But that's wonderful, though. I think you're right, because sometimes, in general, I mean, we do live our lives mimicking the characters that we see on TV or in the films.
Absolutely. And, of course, there are a few guys in television who make a living doing this kind of thing. Aaron Sorkin comes to mind, West Wing and Newsroom, where basically he is selling Aaron Sorkin's message.
Yeah, yeah.
And I respect that.
Yeah.
I also happen to agree with most of his message.
Coming back to you, to your wonderful book, what is the inspiration behind Cross Purposes?
Well, there's a kind of a brief but entertaining backstory about it, Johnny.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some years ago, I used to hang out with a man who had been the head of CBS and MGM, and he was a kind of a brilliant guy. I won't name any names.
Mm-hmm.
For reasons that will become obvious, but he was a brilliant, charming guy, and we became friends. He was flawed. He had a couple of problems. I never encountered either one of them. But he was allegedly beat up women and had a gambling problem. But beyond all of that, he had been very successful, and we would have lunch a half a dozen times a year. We'd go to each other's parties, and we'd come up with ideas for shows, movies, whatever, and go peddle them. One day, it was the beginning of cable and, you know, the expansion of the number of channels, and the reduction in... There was still the same number of eyeballs to go around, you know?
But the
audiences were becoming more scattered. And he said, we got to come up with a series that we can do for less money without standing sets, you know, where we have to pay rent on a sound stage, et cetera, without that overhead. Anyway, schmoozing back and forth over lunch, I came up with a series character, a New York private eye named Barney Moon, who hates L.A. and is stuck there. And worse than that, he doesn't drive, which in Los Angeles it's impossible to survive without driving. And he's got all sorts of attitudes about, L.A. Mm-hmm. So while he's solving his case every week, he's pointing out in asides to the camera, do you believe this place? I mean, how do people live here? You know, with various comparisons to New York, which was in his view, that was civilization.
Yeah.
So anyway, we had a few laughs over lunch, and we're kicking it back and forth. Who will we get to play Barney?
Yeah.
And I don't know which of us came up with Tony Curtis. But I said, yeah, he'd be perfect. I said, I wonder if we could talk to him. He said, I'll call him. So he calls Tony. That was the kind of connections this guy had.
He calls
Tony, puts me on the phone, and I pitch it to him. And Tony loves the idea and comes to the pitch meeting with us dressed as Barney Moon in a rumpled white linen suit. I had never done a pitch. I'd sold a lot of pilots, but never with the actor present.
Yeah.
And we sold it.
Fantastic.
On the
spot. Yeah.
That was the good news. 4 days later, I read in the L.A. Times that the daughter of my partner was suing her father.
Hmm.
He had borrowed her last $75,000 from a big divorce settlement she had gotten from a major producer.
Yeah.
And I knew right away it was his gambling problems. And I called him and said, is this what I think it is? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, Jim, I got two small children. I can't afford to be in business with those guys that are coming after your kneecaps.
Yeah.
So I had to cancel the series. So, but the idea, but the long-winded point to all of this, Johnny, is good ideas don't go away.
Right, right.
And it festered there in my mind for a long time, and I finally decided to turn it into a book.
Fantastic. Well, it is beautifully written. I think the characters in there are hilarious in so many ways, and they're very engaging. Let's talk about that. How do you go about in choosing the various characters?
Well, again, you find fun conflicts, opposing goals, anything that enables an argument of some sort in every scene.
That's interesting. This is funny because I'm thinking like someone like you would, when you sit back, relax, you have this old movie reel playing in your mind before
you put
it down on paper.
Absolutely. And you know, yeah, finding the conflicts don't have to all be deep, you know. They can be as simple as a guy's got indigestion, or you know, he takes an instant irrational dislike to this or that person.
Yeah.
When I say conflict, I mean differences of opinion. The toughest scene to write in an entertaining way is a love scene, because it's two people agreeing with each other.
Yeah.
How do you keep that entertaining? The next time you watch television, especially sitcoms, be aware of this, and you will see that every line of dialogue is an argument. Every scene is an argument. That's what keeps us. That's what keeps us from changing channels.
Interesting. So it could be very subtle in a way, but it's engaging enough, that curiosity kind of thing.
It can be. Well, I was taught early on by these wonderful, hard-nosed, you know, professional writers in the business.
Yeah.
When I would do episodes for them, they would hold my hand and guide me, because the Writers Guild only allowed them to have me write two versions of the story and two drafts of the script, and then after that it was in their hands. So it was in their interest later in mine to hold the writer's hand and guide him, so that when you had to take over his or her script, you didn't have to rewrite it from page one.
Yeah.
And one of the early things they taught me was, even if you've got a character on screen, you're paying him, get your money's worth out of him. Give him an attitude that's in conflict with someone else.
Yeah.
You know, give him a preoccupation. You know, he had a fight with his wife that morning that's still on his mind, or whatever. You know, just to color that character.
Yeah. Every character has weight attached to it?
Well, the good ones especially. One of the best lessons I ever learned in television, I was doing it early on an episode of Wonder Woman for Bruce Lansbury, who was producing the show. He was Angela's brother, but I didn't. I knew him then personally, but not her. Bruce handed me back my first draft of the script, and he said, "Great job. I only have one note." I said, "What's that, Bruce?" He said, "Your bad guy talks too much." Right. Then he expanded on it. It gets better.
Yeah.
He said, and this is so memorable. It's stuck in my. It's like the kind. And it's this is the kind of lesson that you don't get at the Iowa School of Writing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He said, "The thing with bad guys, they have tight, thin mouths, and they don't say much except for their aria."
Huh.
Think about that. I mean,
yeah.
All the James Bond movies with the bad guy.
Yeah.
If he talks too much, he's not threatening.
Right.
He just
is
a regular guy.
Right. Right.
But when he finally does open up, it's when he explains how and why he needs to become the ruler of the world.
Right. Right.
And that keeps him threatening and scary.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, what a wonderful nuts and bolts approach to writing.
Yeah. Well, that's the true psychology of human being. I mean, you meet somebody on the street, who is the one that's intimidating to you? The ones that don't talk a whole lot.
You got it, pal. That's it. I mean, it is all about, you know, we're mirroring reality. We're not dealing with reality, but we're mirroring it. And you mentioned earlier that there are, you know, there's a paucity of these family hour shows anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm distressed by the preoccupation with crazy people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Over
mm-hmm.
and over, as I mentioned, we never did Crazy People on Murder, She Wrote.
Right.
All you get these days is serial killers. And
right.
The thing I find boring about them and boring about the stories is that the story is always the same. It's about the cop or detective trying to get inside the head of a crazy person.
Right.
And having known one or two crazy people in my career and worked with them, I don't ever want to go there.
Yeah. I understand. Well, after a while, it kind of really, it's heavy.
Oh,
that's the best way I can describe it.
But to me, not nearly as interesting as who had the motive and who didn't.
Yeah. To me, that's a very different feeling that one gets. So I don't get into that as much as I enjoy a nice, wonderful sitcom, comedy, refreshing kind of. I want to be entertained, so to speak.
Absolutely, I do too. And serial killers don't entertain.
What is the most challenging aspects in composing a mystery thriller story, if there's any?
The most challenging aspect, Johnny, is staying ahead of your audience, surprising them, which means entertaining them nonstop. And what I mean by staying ahead of them is the challenge is. And particularly, I'm sure you can relate to this because you were a Murder, She Wrote, and you were sitting there every week trying to solve the mystery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't let you solve the mystery. Mm-hmm. Jessica Fletcher has to solve it. And that was the challenge, is that you know, we all play a guessing game. This one did it, this one didn't do it. And we had to plant clues very carefully, something that we had what we called the Playfair clues, that the audience, when they give you the flashback during her final gotcha scene with the murderer, it was the telltale stain on the lapel, it was the this or the that or something she heard.
Right.
And we obviously, when we replayed it, we played it out longer and more clearly, but it was there the first time during the show, and if the audience had been sharp enough, they could have picked up on it. And those are the kinds of things, I mean, the business about not letting the audience get ahead of you, I can't tell you the number of times that I would be writing a script, I'd know who the killer was, and I'd get the final act, and I'd realize that it was too obvious that this one did it. So I'd go back and pick somebody else and then lay in the clues to that. Because I didn't want them to outguess me, the audience.
I see, yeah. I imagine that's very challenging from that standpoint of view. Were there rewarding aspects of composing a murder mystery?
Well, pulling off the above was, of course, the most rewarding of it, you know?
Yeah,
in other words,
yeah.
You know, keeping them entertained and surprising them. And there were also, you know, little side fun things for me, if I can make a political statement. My first two novels were very political. There were conspiracy thrillers. The first one, The 16th Man, about the Kennedy assassination, which I never for a minute believed Oswald had anything to do with.
Yeah.
And 9/11, where I believed that it was, they knew it was in work, and they allowed it to happen, helped it along because they needed an incident to justify having another war.
Yeah,
and so I made those statements in those books.
Yeah.
I've also learned from making those statements that I don't need to do that anymore. And I'll tell you why. What I learned, and I'm using it in other forms, is that once history gets written, it becomes part of the public's comfort zone, and they don't want to revisit it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. It's true.
Even if it was written inaccurately, with out-and-out lies, that's how it becomes etched in stone.
Well, it's almost like who can get the information out first, and then have a few backups, and then that's it.
And the way they want it to be put out.
right. Because once it's out there, it's got some support, and people want to move on.
That's right.
And that's the problem.
It's understandable, and so I cured myself of writing that kind of story.
Coming back to your book, what would you like for the readers to gain from reading Cross Purposes, besides being entertained?
Well, you know, obviously, Barney will. I think I'd like them to like Barney Moon and want to read more Barney Moon stories.
Yeah.
I still think of it as potentially a television series.
Yeah.
Certainly now it's a book series, and I'm working on the second one as we speak.
Yeah.
But I want them to like Barney. I want them to. They don't have to love him 100%. I mean, he can be very abrasive. He's got a lot of attitudes, and that's fine. That for me makes an interesting character. I write stuff that will entertain me. I sold 9 pilots during my television career, and only one of them ever got on the air. But it didn't bother me that they never went further than script, because I was creating ideas for series that I would like to see on the air.
Sure.
I was aware that I was not, Aaron Spelling. I did not have my finger on the pulse of middle America. So I was never going to be as successful as he was, but it didn't matter. Those were the shows. I wrote shows that I wanted to watch.
Sure.
And at least there were people at the networks and studios, a few of them agreed with me, and so I was able to make a nice living at that.
Well, I look at it this way also, Tom, in the sense that when you read a good novel, like Cross Purposes, or even watch a movie or a series, you want to sort of, you can see yourself in that role, and you can live that role for that moment in time. That's entertainment. That's true entertainment, because it takes you away from the present moment that you're in. We all like to be somebody else in some ways. And so a good novel, good writing to me engages that senses in us that give us that feel good, knowing that, wow, for that moment in time, I am that person. And then the values to learn from it as well. Good or bad, the bad things are the ones that you learn from and not do, and the good things are the ones that you want to emulate yourself within your own self and tell yourself that these are the things that makes a difference.
Oh, I agree, Johnny, and I think that the part of the experience of reading or going to a movie and immersing yourself in it, or immersing yourself in a television series, is to escape from your daily problems and so on.
Yeah.
And imagine, wow, how would life be if I lived, say, in Cabot Cove, or if I was a private eye like Barney Moon?
I mean, the character of Barney Moon, for example, to me, when I read about his character, and it reminded me years ago, there was a TV series, The Pretender. Every week, he has to pretend to be somebody else. He sort of immerses himself to be somebody else. To get, obviously,
absolutely,
in that particular case, he was running away. But in this case, for Barney Moon, is to get facts and information.
Absolutely, absolutely. And another example of that kind of character was Jim Rockford, Files.
Right.
He had a printer that printed business cards in his back seat. Barney goes further. He's got a printer and a laminator, so he can make fake IDs on the
spot. It's fun because that's something that engages us. How I would love to be so and so for just that moment in time.
Well, and also to be that rascal.
To
be the guy who makes a living breaking the rules. I think that tickles all of our fantasies.
Sure. Yeah, so true. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, they can, of course, go to Amazon, their local bookstore. And to keep up with my latest happenings, they can go to my website, which is thomasbsawyer.com. And I keep my activities posted there. They can read about my books. They can read about my various projects, including one of my labors of passion. There are highlights from it on my website. Of an opera I co-wrote about Jack Kennedy called Jack, which it looks like it's going to be produced in New York later this year or early next year.
Wonderful. Please tell us about StoryBase 2.0.
Well, StoryBase is a software program created by my son and myself that helps writers come up with stories, plot moves, scenes with edges and conflicts. It's a sort of a brainstorming tool, and we've been out there. You know, there are a lot of similar programs out there, more and more all the time about writing. But this is based on an earlier program that I had created called Plots Unlimited. Which I created back 20 years ago. And StoryBase 2.0 is that program so updated that we renamed it, so improved upon that we renamed it. Very simple to use.
Very interesting. What three things can you share with aspiring writers to help them sharpen their storytelling skills?
Conflict, conflict, conflict. our mandate learned early on in TV was, yeah, as I've said, you've got to entertain. You bore them for 1 second, and mm-hmm, their thumbs on the clicker, changing channels. And so, and plus early on, of course, now there are, you know, cable channels, but
yeah,
back right then, our mandate was to deliver the audience to the commercial break because that was who was paying the bills.
Right. So true.
And
so true.
And the way we did that was to entertain them nonstop, mm-hmm, and never bore them for 1 second. And I teach writing. I have taught at UCLA. I teach writing online now. I teach at writers' conferences. And one of my favorite pieces of advice, I did not originate, William Goldman, the greatest living screenwriter, came mm-hmm up with it. William Goldman, by the way, wrote the script for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, mm-hmm, most famously, but he's written a lot of others. He said, get into your story as late as you can.
Hmm, interesting.
And get into your scenes as late as you can, and get out as early as you can. In other words, start in the middle. Start with the argument already in progress. It is okay to disorient the audience, mm-hmm, to make them wonder what the hell it is they're watching, because if you've hooked them, they'll stay with you to find out.
Right, right. It's a page turner.
And the flip side of it is that in movies and in novels, we do not suffer from what I call the playwright's curse, which is the playwright is stuck with getting people on and off stage. They have to write entrances and exits,
which
tend to be boring. Hello, how are you? I'm Joe Blow. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do that when you're writing a novel or a screenplay. Start in the middle.
That's very interesting. What is next for you?
Well, my next Barney Moon novel, a new production of Jack, and I just sent my memoir to my agent.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
My wife gave it a wonderful title, Johnny. I hope it's good enough to get me a nice advance. my original title was Who Knew? ... But my wife came up with an even better one, The Adventures of the Real Tom Sawyer.
Awesome. I love that one. I love that. That title is very, very catchy. Yeah, I love that. I really like that one. That is really, very good.
Publishing houses agree.
I'm sure they will agree with you. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
I'm not sure I want to be pontificating, but my own approach is the following. If I'm sure I can pull off the next thing, why do it? My comfort zone is some level of angst about whether or not I can do the next project. So I keep raising my inner bar. And additionally, advice-wise, I tell people to put themselves in luck's way, in a place where it can happen, out there. You know, most talented people go through life sort of cranky because the world hasn't discovered all by itself how beautiful and talented they are. Well, it doesn't happen that way very often. You have to put yourself out there and really grab people by the collar and make them aware and you know, in this case, you know, grab them by the throat and say, look, you got to read cross purposes. Or this is who I am. It's why, you know, it's why you know people play at it. They touch, mm-hmm. they do Facebook, they do, you know, LinkedIn and so on.
Yeah.
And those are valid,
yeah.
valid areas, but it's not enough because everybody else is doing it too.
Right.
So part of, and I'm sure you've been aware of this in your business, you got to be marketing yourself all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So true. And, of course, we talk about personal branding. That's who you are. You have
absolutely.
To go out
there. Absolutely, and that's why I have, when people go to my website, they will see that it's got no, it's not overproduced, it's got no style or jazzy artistic mm-hmm. touches to it, because my feeling about it is this is the place that I tell people what I want them to know about me.
Mm-hmm. So true.
And I think having a website is essential because when people Google your name, that's the first thing they come up with. Now, they may want to know more about you than is on the website. That's fine. But that's the first place they look. And so I want to keep that as current and sales positive as I can.
So true. So true. Tom, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be reinvention expert and USA Today best-selling author Claire Cook. Claire and I will be discussing her latest collaborative book project with Chicken Soup for the Soul, titled Reboot Your Life. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Tom, it has been a true pleasure talking with you this morning. Thank you again, and have a blessed day, sir.
Well, thank you, Johnny. It's been a terrific interview, and I wish you continuing success.
Thank you, sir. Likewise to you. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.